Right. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to this this webinar. It's a special treat. We've got Dr. Choi with us today. He is an accomplished chiropractor in his own right, turned biomechanical expert, and we are very excited to have him here talking about the differences between those two things and how he got from one to the other. So with no other introduction, welcome, Dr. Choi. Thank you for being here.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Choi, before we get started here, we're doing a major experiment. We got Alex Eisner here. You can tell he's in the center of the picture. I can't move him out of this chair. So we're going to let him try to run this show, but you guys had a case together. A, it would be nice if we could see some animation. I bet you thought about that, didn't you, young Alex? But secondly, we got a great penetrating question that we got from a doctor, which, by the way, going forward for our future what are we? These are not webinars, are they?
Well, we used to call them our PI teleconferences, but we've moved to a Zoom platform. I think this is better.
Okay, yeah, I like it. I like it much better. Doctors, we do have a specialist here that is something that we have used, worked with professionally. It's something that we need to know a lot about biomechanics. And by the way, you're all taught that in colleges. And so many of you certainly can testify to the biomechanical damages on patients in PI cases. It's important. Dr. Choi's taken it up several levels, and so now he's working with different attorneys, putting demonstrable evidence and cases together that helps us. During this, we want you to send us email, SeanSteele@SeanSteele.com. Next time you can have Alex's email, but that'll be after he earns it. So ask me any question during the seminar. We'll get it answered. You can also press the one button on your phone, and you can also intrude. No, you can't.
Not anymore.
Oh, not anymore. So
you can do it on Zoom. You can write a question.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, in the chat room, you can certainly do that. And then we're going to keep it to 30 minutes, as we always promise, to get you out of here quickly. And then Alex, because he's really nice today, is going to have a video copy of this.
Yeah. We'll post it on YouTube, hopefully.
And also on our website.
Yeah.
What is our website?
SeanSteele.com.
Oh, that's great. That's my name.
That's your name.
Okay, good. Very good.
It's all right back here, too.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, in case you miss it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to step out of the picture, literally. Let's see if Alex does a good job. Why don't you tell me secretly on email that I'll see. He won't see it. Tell me how he's doing. Give him a rating of 1 to 10, and I appreciate it.
It's like a pain scale.
Yeah.
Well, Doctor, thanks again for being here. I wondered if you couldn't start by giving us something of a history and a definition. If you could maybe define biomechanics, biomechanical engineering, what it takes to be a biomechanical expert, and then your qualifications and how you got into it.
Okay, well, just to clarify some stuff, first of all, if you are a biomechanical expert, the notion that you have to be an engineer is absolutely false. So right now, currently, the vast majority of biomechanical experts are engineers. However, the notion that you have to be an engineer to be a biomechanical expert is not true. So that comes with the genesis of how biomechanics actually even came across. If you actually look historically, it was the healthcare profession that actually brought upon biomechanics in the industry today. 19th century orthopedic surgeons and obstetricians were actually engaged in biomechanics. Like in 1880, German orthopedic surgeon named Otto Messner, he actually published the first biomechanical article. It was in German, but roughly translated, it means elasticity and strength, about the tensile strength of fetuses when they're being pulled out of the womb during birth. I mean, that was the genesis of, around that time was the genesis of biomechanics. 1874, British Medical Journal, that was the one with the tensile strength. There's other, actually the 1880 report was actually about orthopedists, where they experimented with cadavers, breaking bones, and then figuring out how to, what was the best method of fixing them. So biomechanics started way back in the late 1800s. And even in 1919, there's a doctor, medical doctor, Marshall, and he published in the Boston Medical Journal, neck injuries due to low or mild automobile crashes. And keep in mind, back then, automobiles didn't have the head restraints that we have today. So back then, you know, and you, I'd like to show some, a couple of videos of low impact collisions a little bit later, but even at crashes less than 10 miles per hour, you can see how dynamic the collisions are. And with the absence of head restraints, people were receiving catastrophic injuries because of that.
So let me ask you, how did you end up getting into this?
Well, over a decade ago, you know, I just started to go to different seminars. You know, I treated a lot of different types of patients, but, you know, I was focusing on personal injury patients. And, you know, many times, I'm sure many of you chiropractors experience today that your case gets denied for whatever reason that the carriers use. And a lot of times I basically, what I did was I rebutted the letters. I asked the attorneys, I said, hey, can you send me those denial letters? I'd like to look at it and rebut it. And I'd rebut it. And typically the response is, hey, I'm sorry, you're not an expert witness. You don't qualify to opine on these issues. So then I reply, you know, hey, do you guys qualify to talk about patients' injuries? And basically what happens, they ignore it. So, you know, I just said, you know, I'm just going to get certified in this type of stuff. So in 2008, I got certified in whiplash biomechanics. And in 2009, I got certified in accident reconstruction.
Okay, so you were a chiropractor, then you got certified in accident reconstruction biomechanics. Give me a little bit of background for maybe myself or any of the doctors who might not know. What's the difference between defining injuries, you know, as a chiropractor would as a diagnosis versus defining injuries biomechanically?
Right. I guess you could say that you're basically going more detail into analyzing a person's injury. Like, for example, how many of us take x-rays? I mean, the vast majority of chiropractors take x-rays. When you take a lateral view of an x-ray, you see localized degenerative changes between the C5, C6 vertebrae, where you see some DJD there, but the other joints look fine. I can tell you right now that that person at one point or another suffered some type of acceleration, deceleration injury, aka whiplash, because it is typically on the vast majority of the population that's out there, the axis of rotation when your head is moving forwards and backwards is the center rotation is between C5 and C6. So when you suffer whiplash, that area gets damaged more than the other areas and it undergoes premature DJD. So you know, analyzing an x-ray right off the bat when you see localized DJD, that's typically caused by some type of trauma in the past. But if you have a patient that just came into your office and you're actually analyzing them, MRI is a great way to determine what the biomechanical factors are in a personal injury case that involves motor vehicle collision. Like, for example, you're driving, you get T-boned, your head snaps to one side. Now, keep in mind, the ligaments that house the vertebral bodies, right, they're physical barriers that prevent bulges from occurring. So when you have a lateral bulge, and unfortunately, most radiologists, they don't really go in detail when it comes to reading x-rays about laterality. They just look at the side view, they measure how much it comes out, whether it's pushing on the cord or not. But if you can actually see that the bulge is paracentral to the right, in my case, my head snapped this way, what's going to happen is it's going to cause a stretching of the paraspinal ligaments on my right side. And you'll actually see the bulge paracentral to the right. Now, for younger people, say in their 30s, that typically don't have degenerative changes, so they're not going to have as much, bulging or whatnot. You see several bulges that are paracentral to the right, then you know it follows the biomechanics of that collision vector. So that's one way to analyze a person's injury. Number one. Number two. Another factor, like, for example, you know, just typical whiplash, right? Your head snaps forward, all the posterior longitudinal ligaments, they uniformly stretch. So that's when you see on an MRI, you see multiple small bulges in several different locations is another indicator that this was caused by some type of acceleration, deceleration injury.
So is there anything that you're looking for in the chiropractic report in terms of what chiropractors listening in on this sort of thing could be doing better, or noting specifically if they know a biomechanics expert or you particularly are going to end up on that case, that they should be looking for or noting, or maybe they should just be looking for and noting in all of their PI cases to try to bolster the liability picture and the biomechanics picture?
Right. So there's a ton of research out there that that you can utilize to basically input in your report in a title if you're going to title it mechanism of injury, because there's so much research out there. For example, like wearing a seatbelt. Yes, seatbelts definitely save lives, and we must all wear seatbelts. However, in lower impact collisions, because the typical consumer vehicle that has a 3-point harness. So if I'm a driver, what's going to happen is if you get rear-ended as you're going through phase three and you are going forward and the seatbelt catches, that will actually cause a torquing effect of your neck. And that actually increases soft tissue injuries. That's one factor. And there's a lot of research behind it. Like, I use a software called Titan, and basically it has a mechanism of injury section in there. And whatever you pick, it actually talks about that and tells you all the article references that are on there. Not being completely surprised. People who are surprised, actually, their head whips more, and therefore they're more prone to longer injuries and chronic effects.
So just to touch on that, because that comes up in a lot of cases where they will ask, and it's worth noting maybe for the chiropractor to ask in the initial intake whether or not somebody was surprised by the accident, meaning they saw it coming or they didn't see it coming. You're saying that that can actually have an effect on the extent of the injuries, and that should be or could be commented on in the report.
Right, absolutely. But keep in mind, that's a two-edged sword, because in lower impact collisions, if you're not aware of what's going on and you're completely surprised of it, your jerk is going to be much greater, and therefore you're going to have greater injury, more likely to have chronic injury. However, the other side is if it's a high impact collision where, you know, you're exceeding a certain speed limit and you actually see it coming and you tense up, because in lower impact collisions, if you tense up and you're ready for it, then you reduce the amount of jerk. But if you're at a higher velocity collision where you grab onto that steering wheel and you're jerking, that can actually cause broken bones. So that's why in higher velocity collisions where, like, for example, like drunk drivers, you know, they get into a car wreck, everyone dies except for them, because everyone else saw it coming, they held on, and while the car is going through the collision factors or it's rolling, they're tensed up, and as they're tensed up, their bones are breaking and they end up dying. Whereas the drunk person is so drunk, it's like kind of like rolling with the punches, and they just flop around and they end up surviving the collision. So it kind of goes both ways depending on what the speed of the collision was.
Gotcha. All right. So something that comes up quite a lot, and I'm sure a lot of the docs are familiar with the term a missed case, a minor impact soft tissue case. It sounds like this might be your bread and butter. I mean, this is something that you are a specialist in terms of coming in on cases that could be labeled missed, and explaining how it is that just because the impact might have been minor, or the damages in dollars might have been minor, or the injuries might be soft tissue injuries, doesn't mean that it's a low value case, or it doesn't mean that the injuries aren't chronic, or it doesn't mean that the injuries can't have actually been larger. Can you talk a little bit about your work in low impact collisions and how low impact collisions can still lead to, if they can, still lead to damages?
Right. Well, you know, as far as the speed of the collision, if it's considered deemed a low impact collision, as far as the value of a case, that, you know, it's beyond me. But, I go more into whether the person can be injured or not. That's the important factor as a treating doctor. So ever since the turn of the century, basically what happened was different organizations like the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety kept increasing the speeds at which they do these collision tests. So, you know, when you look at a vehicle, there's three zones of crush. And the first zones are the two bumpers. So there you go, the two bumpers, right? And then there's the crumple zone, which is the trunk or the engine compartment. and then there's the cage where the occupant sits. Now, the bumpers are stiff, and then the crush stones are soft, and then once again, the cage is stiff again. So as they kept increasing the speeds at which they do these collisions, they had to be able to absorb more energy before it got to the cage. And the cage is like the holy of holies. You know, you can't, if the cage gets compromised, dummies show the damage, the intrusion to the cage, then the manufacturers get poor safety ratings. So now they're doing offset studies, cage crashes at like 40 miles per hour. So they have to keep stiffening up the bumper, or stiffening up the bumpers, because they're not going to redesign the engine, right? I mean, that's a brand new car. So during the turn of the century, they started adding things like energy absorbers that stiffened up the bumpers. Now they add like impact bars that really stiffen up the bumpers. And especially with the advent of electric cars with the batteries are like Toyota and Tesla on the floor. These frames are almost indestructible. So I've seen collisions at 30 miles per hour where one car is completely like accordioned in up to the windshield, while the other car, you could barely tell that there's even any type of damage on it. So what happens is when you do a teardown, and the covers are designed so they just bounce back, they're like rubber covers, right? So it's really important for you to go beyond that, and like the repairs, you know, people that do the repairs, man, to do a teardown and look at the internal damage. Because when you have energy absorber damage or impact bar damage, and literally from the outside it looks like there's no damage, but that's going to far exceed 10 miles per hour collisions. And when it exceeds 10 miles per hour collisions, you know, there's no question as to whether a person could be injured or not.
So, and that brings up an interesting point. So we're doing all of this to determine the speed at which the collision may have occurred. But a lot of people have heard the term delta V. Why don't you start by just tell us what a delta V is, and then why all of why is everybody so interested in what the delta V value is in an accident?
Right. Okay. Well, okay. The reason why delta V is so important when it comes to med legal is because there's been attempts by several different companies that try to establish a quote unquote threshold for injury. And basically what delta V means is the change in velocity, right? So imagine, if we will, this two cars. If this car is at a standstill and this car comes and hits it, let's say at 10 miles per hour, and this car from 0 miles per hour goes to 6 miles per hour, speeds up to 6 miles per hour, that would have been a delta V of 6 miles per hour. Now, basically what happened is that, you know, if you look at different types of research and stuff like that, a lot of defense-oriented companies, they claim that delta V, the threshold for injury, is at 5 miles per hour, whereas different studies by different researchers in real-world collision factors say that people on average begin to suffer injuries at 3.9 miles per hour. Now, when you look at 3.9 miles per hour, 5 miles per hour, or even like say 8-9 miles per hour, it doesn't seem like much, right? But in your, if you can imagine, if you will, you're walking, you know, a slow, steady paced walk is about 3 miles per hour. And say there's a beam right here, it's thickly padded, and I'm walking 3 miles per hour and I hit my head on it, my head snaps back, would you get injured? Me, I don't think I would. I'm fairly healthy, I don't have any pre-existing conditions. But how about your grandmother? Would they get injured? Okay. How about a slow paced jog? Now, keep in mind, a less than 10 mile per hour collision with zero damage to both cars is typically under 10 miles per hour. That will generate about a 6 delta V. Okay. So say I'm doing a brisk walk. Okay. That's about 4 miles per hour, right? Brisk walk. Here's the ledge thickly padded. We're not talking about forehead injury. I'm just talking about the head snapping back, and I'm not even talking about the jerk that occurs after that. But at 4 miles per hour, brisk walk, you hit your head snaps back, would you get injured? Well, how about a slow-paced jog? Okay, a slow-paced jog is about 5 miles per hour, right? So imagine if you're jogging at 5 miles per hour, and here's that beam again, you hit your head and you snap back, would you get injured, right? Most of the time, when you start to see damages on a vehicle, right? Just when you just start to see damage on a vehicle, that usually exceeds 10 miles per hour delta V. So How about a sprint? Okay, twice the speed of a slow paced jog, right? A sprint, right? So if you're running, here's that beam, you hit that head and your head snaps back, ask yourself, would you get injured? I mean, it's almost a no-brainer, right? So unfortunately, the way they designed the car, it's a trade-off. Once again, it's a two-edged sword. In slower and lower collision type of impacts, yes, the person's going to end up suffering more injury because all the energy is not transferred into crush, and it's catapulted into the occupant, creating more jerk. But in higher impact collisions, yes, the car will absorb the energy and the person will survive, you know. So yeah, we get more injured in the car accident, but at least we get to live. So, you know, kudos for the engineers.
Right. One more thing I want to do, and then I want you to show us some videos, and then we've got a question that somebody wrote in, and then we'll let everybody go. G-forces. This is another buzzword that we hear in popular culture. In my world, I hear it in personal injury litigation. How does that relate to what you're talking about?
Right. So that's G-force. Basically, in order to calculate G-forces, you have to first know what the delta V is, because the delta V is the actual change in velocity of the vehicle. But then you use delta V to eventually calculate what the acceleration rate or the G-force of the occupant was, or how much G-force were induced into the occupant. So that's basically what we have to analyze. So, you know, in the world of accident reconstruction, you know, accident reconstructionists are the ones that will go about analyzing the damage factors to determine what the delta V is. And once you establish delta V, then you use a series of different, very simple calculations to figure out how much G-forces were induced into the occupant.
Gotcha. And does it translate nicely, just like they want the delta V values to translate nicely? Is it like X G's injury beneath that number, no injury? Does it work like that?
Well, of course not. I mean, we're all doctors, and we understand that there's a human factor. I mean, myself versus someone that's much older, or myself versus someone that already had a series of injuries to the neck, and they have higher risk factors. So the thing is, you know, trying to put a norm or quote unquote threshold for when person gets injured, that just, you know, they can do that in the world of research, you know, because they want to create, you know, certain numbers. But in the real world with human beings, everyone has to be analyzed or diagnosed and examined individually.
But we also hear sometimes in PI that, you know, a sneeze will generate 5 G's, or stepping off of a curb or sitting down on a chair will generate, you know, 10 G's momentarily. So, and obviously those things don't injure people. So how come this accident, which only generated, you know, 6 G's, momentarily or something, how did that injure this person, or 2 G's or something like that? Why is that ridiculous? Obviously I'm smiling, but why is that ridiculous?
Yeah, actually, that is very ridiculous. And the main reason why is because the parameters of how the forces are induced is completely different. Like, for example, when I'm sneezing or stepping off a curb or sitting in a chair, the forces are all up and down, right? But it's vertical, right? But in a car accident, everything's moving, so it's horizontal. It's actually moving, right? Number one. So the forces that are induced into the occupant versus someone sitting or sneezing is completely different. So in the world of research, to say that they're the same thing is really, it's utterly ridiculous, number one. Number two, there's things that happen, especially like in a rear-end collision, that does not happen to a person sneezing. So for example, if you guys just all do this very slowly, because I don't know who's out there that's watching this, but I want you to experience this and know what it feels like when you're rear-ended. The first thing happens in a rear-end collision is you get shear forcing, where the car pushes into you and your neck goes straight back. Now, put your chin all the way in, and from here, move your head slow. And I mean it, go slowly. Put your chin all the way in, move your head slowly back. You'll feel that pain. You can feel that pain on your shoulder, in your neck area. That does not happen when you're sneezing. Who puts their chin in and then sneezes, right? Who puts their chin in, sits and plops into a chair? Who puts their chin in and steps off a curb?
Right.
And you know what? And the study that you're relating to, it's called the Allen study, and it's a notorious study that defense experts use for a long time. They're kind of weaning off of that because it's getting so exposed, but you know, a quote-unquote researcher, a learned person that's supposed to be, if they are, I'm not sure, but if they are a biomechanist or an expert in biomechanics, to try to compare and say apples and oranges are the same thing, you know, it's just...
disingenuous.
Yeah, I would agree to that.
So we have only a couple of minutes left. I wanted to give you at least, you know, 60, 90 seconds if you had a video you wanted to show and you could share your screen. So, and then we have one question that that I want to make sure I ask you that a doctor wrote in beforehand.
Okay, so this, I'm going to share the screen. I just want to explain to you, this is a collision at 8.2 miles per hour. These videos can actually be purchased from the Spine Research Institute. It is copywritten, so, but I'm showing it for educational purposes and I'm not capitalizing on this whatsoever. So this is fine. 8.2 miles per hour with a delta V of 6.3, and there's zero damage to both cars. Let's see that again. 8.2 miles per hour. How much damage does that look like? That scratch was already there to begin with. So you got to ask yourself, let's see that one more time.
It sounds like the type of collision that would get labeled a missed case.
Right, absolutely. Now, keep in mind, of course, you know, when you do this type of research, you have to make sure that they have no risk factors, they're healthy, there's nothing predisposing them to any type of injury. And this was only 6.3 delta V, right? So, you know, to a healthy individual, you know, they might not get injured, which is fine, right? But how about older people or people with significant health issues, right? You know, they are highly prone to getting injured. And the research that Dr. Kropp did from the Spine Research Institute actually showed that all the volunteers that were involved in this, they did post-study 6-month and 12-month interviews. More than 70% of them started developing headaches, neck pain, and issues like that without any causational factors in between.
Yeah, looks rough. Well, Doc, I appreciate you showing me that. I want to ask you one quick question with the last 2 minutes that we have here. Dr. Fantasia wrote in this morning and asked how you defend against cases where, you know, your party was rear-ended, but the insurance company is trying to make the claim that that they were actually a middle car and that they rear-ended the car in front of them before they got rear-ended.
Right. So this is a topic that comes up quite often, and this has to do with the accident reconstruction portion of it. But keep in mind, if there's two cars and say there's another car right here and you're in the, or whichever car that you're analyzing, what happens is this, if you're in the middle car, okay, and that's apparently the patient of the doctor that wrote the question, someone rear-ends the middle car. Now, when you get rear-ended and you're at a stop, right, what's going to happen? You accelerate forward, right? When you accelerate forward, what happens? Your vehicle pitches upward, okay? So you need to analyze the damage of the car that's in the very, very front, because if this car accelerated and it pitched upward and the damage is above where the bumper heights are, because you can get the specifications of the vehicles. So when they're in the acceleration phase and the vehicle pitches up and it hits higher from where the normal heights are, then you know that he was hit first. The middle car was hit, accelerated forward, and went down. If the middle car was the one that hit the front car first, typically they're hitting the brakes. They slam on the brakes. And what happens when you slam on the brakes? It pitches downward, right? But once again, the damage would be more below.
Doctor, thank you so much. We are out of time completely. If any of the chiropractors have follow-up questions, where can they find you?
They can email me at dr.choi@atlashealthclinic.com.
That is so nice of you. Dr. Choi, thank you so much for being here with us and answering all of these questions and explaining what you do. And I appreciate it very, very much. And we will see all these doctors hopefully on the next call in 1 month. Sean, anything?
Yeah. Doctors, you can find this material right on our website, johnsteele.com. We also have a new channel on that this guy fixed up on YouTube called the Sean Steele Law Firm. We got a lot of funny videos. His are funny, mine are serious. But we try to keep new tips on litigation under 5 minutes. So 30 minutes with Dr. Choi is outstanding. Next time we're going to have a few more animations. Dr. Choi, we're not done with you. You've got a lot of information. You've got a lot of for you to be. This is another aspect of the growth and maturity of chiropractic. And we need smart people like this in our lives. Thank you, doctors. Thank you, Dr. Choi.
Thank you so much.